Chapter 20. Elizabeth Devereaux said nothing more. She just climbed into her Caprice and drove away. She pulled a wide U-turn in front of me and headed north back to town. I lost sight of her after the first curve. I stood still for a long moment and then set off walking. 10 minutes later, I was through the last of the rural meanders and the road widened and straightened in front of me. Main Street, in fact, as well as name. Some daytime activity was starting up. The stores were opening. I saw 2 cars and 2 pedestrians, but that was all. Carter Crossing was no kind of a bustling metropolis. That was for damn sure. I walked on the right-hand sidewalk and passed the hardware store, and the pharmacy, and the hotel, and the diner, and the empty space next to it. Devereaux's car was not parked in the sheriff's department lot. No police vehicles were. There were 2 civilian pickup trucks there, both of them old and battered and modest. The desk clerk and the dispatcher, presumably. Locally recruited. No union, no benefits. I thought again about my friend Stan Lowry and his want ads. He would aim higher, I guessed. He would have to. He had girlfriends. Plural. He had mouths to feed. I made it to the T-junction and turned right. In the daylight, the road speared dead straight ahead of me. Narrow shoulders, deep ditches. The traffic lanes banked up and over the rail crossing, and then the shoulders and the ditches resumed and the road ran onward through the trees. There was a truck parked my side of the crossing, facing me. A big, blunt-nosed thing, brush-painted in a dark color. 2 guys in it, staring at me. Fur, ink, hair, dirt, grease. My 2 pals from the night before. I walked on, not fast, not slow, just strolling. I got within about 20 yards. Close enough for me to see detail in their faces, close enough for them to see detail in mine. This time they got out of their truck. The doors opened as one, and they climbed out and down. They skirted the hood and stood together in front of the grill. Same height, same build, like cousins. They were each about 6'2" and around 200 or 210 pounds. They had long, knotted arms and big hands, work boots on their feet. I walked on. I stopped 10 feet away. I could smell them from there. Beer, cigarettes, rancid sweat, dirty clothes. The guy on my right said,
"Hello again, soldier boy."
He was the alpha dog. Both times he had been driving, and both times he was the first to speak. Unless the other guy was some kind of a silent mastermind, which seemed unlikely. I said nothing. Of course. The guy asked,
"Where are you going?"
I didn't answer. The guy said,
"You're going to Kelm. I mean, where the hell else does this road go?"
He turned and swept his arm through an extravagant gesture, indicating the road and its relentless straightness and its lack of alternative destinations. He turned back and said,
"Last night you told us you weren't from Kelm. You lied to us."
I said, "Maybe I live on that side of town."
"No," the guy said. "If you'd tried living on that side of town, we'd have visited you before."
"For what purpose?"
"To explain the facts of life. Different places are for different folks."
He came a little closer. His buddy came with him. The smell grew stronger. I said, "You guys need to take a bath. Not necessarily together." The guy on my right asked,
"What have you been doing this morning?"
I said, "You don't want to know."
"Yes, we do."
"No," You really don't. You're not welcome here. Not anymore. None of you. It's a free country, I said. Not for people like you. Then he paused, and his gaze suddenly shifted and focused into the far distance over my shoulder. The oldest trick in the book, except this time he wasn't faking. I didn't turn, but I heard a car on the road behind me. Far away, a big car, quiet, with wide highway tires. Not a cop car, because no recognition dawned in the guy's eyes, no familiarity. It was a car he hadn't seen before. A car he couldn't explain. I waited, and it swept past us. It was going fast. It was a black town car. Urban. Dark windows. It thumped up the rise, pattered across the tracks, and thumped back down again. Then it kept on going straight. A minute later, it was tiny in the haze, effectively lost to sight. An official visitor heading to Kellam. Rank and prestige. Or panic. The guy on my right said, "You need to get back on the base, and then stay there." I said nothing. "But first, you need to tell us what you've been doing, and who you've been seeing. Maybe we should go check she's still alive." I said, "I'm not from Kellam." The guy took a step forward. He said, "Liar." I took a breath and made like I was going to speak. Then I headbutted the guy full in the face. No warning. I just braced my feet and snapped forward from the waist and crashed my forehead into his nose. Bang! It was perfectly done. Timing, force, impact. It was all there in full measure. Plus, surprise. No one expects a headbutt. Humans don't hit things with their heads. Some inbuilt atavistic instinct says so. A headbutt changes the game. It adds a kind of unhinged savagery to the mix. An unprovoked headbutt is like bringing a sawed-off shotgun to a knife fight. The guy went down like an empty suit. His brain told his knees it was out of business, and he folded up and fell over backward. He was unconscious before he hit the floor. I could tell by the way the back of his head hit the road. No attempt to soften the blow. It just smacked down with a thud. Maybe he added some fractures in back to match the ones I had given him in front. His nose was bleeding badly. It was already starting to swell. The human body is a self-healing machine, and it doesn't waste time. The other guy just stood there, the silent mastermind, or the beta dog. He was staring at me. I took a long step to my left and headbutted him, too. Bang! Like a double bluff. He was completely unprepared. He was expecting a fist. He went down in the same kind of heap. I left him there on his back, 6 feet from his buddy. I would have taken their truck to save myself some time and effort, but I couldn't stand the stink in the cab, so I walked on to the railroad track, where I turned left on the ties and headed north. I came off the track a little earlier than I had the night before and traced the wreck's debris field from its very beginning. The smaller and lighter pieces had traveled shorter distances. Less momentum, I supposed. Less kinetic energy, or more air resistance, or something. But the smaller beads of glass and the smaller flakes of metal were the first to be found. They had stalled and fluttered and fallen to earth and come to rest well before the heavier items, which had barreled onward. It had been a fairly old car. The collision had exploded it like a diagram. But some parts hadn't put up much of a fight. There were squares and flakes of rust from the underbody. They were layered and scaly and caked with dirt. An old car with significant time spent in cold climates where they salt the roads in winter, not a Mississippi native. A car that had been hauled from pillar to post, 6 months here, 6 months there, regularly, unpredictably. A soldier's car, probably. I walked on and turned and tried to gauge the general vector. Debris had sprayed through a fan shape, narrow at first, widening later. I pictured a license plate, a small rectangle of thin, featherweight alloy, bursting free of its bolts, sailing through the nighttime air, stalling, falling, maybe end over end. I tried to figure out where it might have landed. I couldn't see it anywhere, not inside the fan shape, not on its edges, not beyond its edges. Then I remembered the howling gale that had accompanied the train, and I widened my area of search. I pictured the plate caught in a miniature tornado, whipping and spiraling through the roiled air, going high, maybe even going backward. In the end, I found it still attached to the chrome bumper I had seen the night before. The bumper had folded up just left of the plate and made a point which had half buried itself in the scrub, like a spear. I rocked it loose and pulled it out and turned it over and saw the plate hanging from a single black bolt. It was an Oregon plate. It featured a drawing of a salmon behind the number, some kind of a wildlife initiative, protect the natural environment. The tags were current and up to date. I memorized the number and reburied the bent bumper in its hole. Then I walked on to where the bulk of the wreck had burned against the trees. By bright daylight, I agreed with Pellegrino. The car had been blue, a light, powdery shade like a winter sky. Maybe it had started life that way, or maybe it had faded a little with age. But either way, I found enough unblemished paint to be sure. There was an intact patch inside what had been the glove box. There was an overspray stripe under melted plastic trim inside one of the doors. Not much else had survived. No personal items. No paperwork of any kind, no discarded material, no hairs, no fibers, no ropes, no belts, no straps, no knives. I wiped my hands on my pants and walked back the way I had come. The two guys and their truck had gone. I guessed the silent mastermind had woken up first. The beta dog. I had hit him less hard. I guessed he had hauled his buddy into the truck and taken off, slow and shaky. No harm done. No major harm, anyway. Nothing permanent. For him, at least. The other one would have a headache for 6 months or so. I stood on the spot where they had gone down and saw another black car coming toward me from the west, another town car, fast and purposeful, wallowing and wandering a little on the uneven road. It had a good wax shine and black window glass. It blew past me at speed, thumped up, pattered over the rail line, thumped down again, and rushed onward toward Kellam. I turned and watched it, and then I turned back and started walking again. No particular place to go, except I was hungry by that point, so I headed for Main Street and the diner. The place was empty. I was the only customer. The same waitress was on duty. She met me at the hostess station and asked,
"Is your name Jack Reacher?"
I said, "Yes, ma'am, it is." She said,
"There was a woman in here an hour ago looking for you."